Welcome to What We Watch When We Drink, a Booze Dancing Entertainment Network podcast featuring lively discussions about movies, TV shows, and anything else that we're watching while we drink our favorite boozy beverages. If you enjoy this show, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, Audible, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. You can also find us on boozedancing.com, and if you have any questions, comments, show, or drink suggestions, email us at boozedancing@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Hey now. Hello. The Booze Dancing Entertainment Network is live on a Sunday morning. Usually it's a Wednesday. Usually it's a Whiskey Wednesday. Now it's a Sunday afternoon, depending on where you are.
An evening.
Welcome to What We Watch When We Drink. We are live on YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. This is episode 76, I believe, on the Booze Dancing Entertainment Network. Drop those comments in the chat, and we'll be sure to either ignore them or, I don't know, we may read them, we'll see. And keep the cards and letters coming. Don't forget to watch these two gentlemen to my left on my screen. Angelo and Mike at the murder table, where they do all kinds of reviews of whiskey and beer and all kinds of spirits. At boozedancing.com. Today, we are coming to you from across many time zones. And on a Sunday, which is traditionally for the Booze Dancing team, the day we recover from Friday and Saturday nights, today we are pulling double duty. We are recovering and welcoming, those are our said duties. We are welcoming a very special guest this morning to us, Annabelle Thomas, all the ways from south of England. Hi, Annabelle. Thank you for coming.
Hello.
Hello,
thanks
hello.
For having me. I'm very excited to be here.
This is exciting, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Exciting to have you.
So it's 8 p.m. your time, correct?
That's right. Yep.
Wow. And it's 3 p.m. for the boys on the East Coast here in the States and noontime for me. So we are covering many, many time zones here. How are we on this Sunday?
So it's nightcaps in England. It's almost happy hour on the East Coast.
Yes,
and it's Sunday brunch on the West Coast.
Yeah, that's right. This is the best.
Perfect.
So we are going to chat all things McNean with the founder of said distillery in Scotland, and we are going to talk about a little bit of television as well. Correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
How are we? We're all good. We're all ready for this. Good.
Yes.
Good. Annabelle, thank you. Thank you for coming on today. Before we go too crazy, tell us a little bit about McNean. And you know, you guys have been around what, 10 years or so, ish.
Nearly. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, it's crazy.
Yeah.
I feel like whenever the name comes up, I always think, "Oh, that's a new distillery." Well, it kind of is, but it's not so new anymore.
I know, which is a little bit terrifying, actually.
One question: pronunciation. Proper pronunciation. How do you say it?
McNean.
McNean. Okay.
Yeah. You probably Nick never like, get that question.
Nick like Mook and then Nean. Very simple. Or Neen if you really want to say it quickly. But
got it. Well, I like how you put the pronunciation on the back of the bottle. I have a bottle.
Yes, exactly.
Yes,
we do.
Very helpful.
Because we get that question a lot, and or we don't get the question and people are too embarrassed to ask. So one or the other.
Because it's so obvious.
Exactly.
Why would you ask that question?
I mean, I thought it was obvious when we launched, but it turns out it's not obvious to everybody else. So, you know, some of the things.
Coming up with a name is a tough thing in the branding world, right? You gotta.
Absolutely.
So while we're talking about it, how did you get the name? Or what is.
Well, I wanted. Part of the whole philosophy of why I set McNean up was that I wanted to do something a bit different in Scotch. There's loads of amazing traditional distilleries out there doing their thing, doing it amazingly. Scotch is this hugely traditional industry, but there didn't seem to be anyone doing anything different. And I felt like what Scotch also needed, as well as all of these traditional wonderful distilleries, was a modern forward-looking distillery that could concentrate on things like sustainability and innovation, which is much harder for the existing distilleries to do, either from a practical point of view, because they can't change the way they make things, or from a kind of philosophical point of view, because they're kind of doing things the way they've always been done. And I wanted a name that represented that philosophy. rather than doing what everyone else does, which is call it the name of the place, which seemed a bit boring to me. So we looked back in the Gaelic history books and we found this goddess called Nish Neohane. And she was known as a protector of nature and for walking her own path. And I thought that so neatly summed up everything we were trying to do. I wanted her to represent us, but that's like 13 letters long. And I didn't want to type it 100 times a day, let alone ask anyone else to pronounce, type, anything else. So we shortened it to Nick Nian, and the apostrophe after the NC is meant to represent the fact that we condensed it and took letters out. But the other fun fact I discovered afterwards, actually, which I didn't know as we were choosing it, that Nook is the female equivalent of Mook. So Mook Donald means son of Donald, and Nook means daughter of.
There you go.
And
we're
that
learning
is commonly,
things. I like it.
Exactly. And that's commonly used in Irish Gaelic still, but it's not really still used in Scotland. So it's also a nice bit of linguistic history in there.
There you go.
Wow, that's interesting. So let's jump back a little farther back, but not to Gaelic times. Little farther ahead. So what is your relationship, or what was your relationship to whiskey prior to opening the distillery? Had you worked in the industry? Had you worked in the distillery?
No.
Had you ever had a taste of whiskey before?
Yes. I didn't work in the industry at all. I had a very corporate career in London as a strategy consultant. Very boring. Well paid, better paid than whiskey, but quite boring. And I did that for about 8 years. But I'd always had very strong connections to Scotland. I'd been dragged there initially by my parents from a very young age. And then I fell in love with it, as tends to happen, I found, through life. And when I was in my early 20s, my parents bought the farm that the distillery is on. I love the place where the farm, I got married there. And it was also the place I first fell in love with whiskey, although that did take quite a long time. I spent most of my 20s trying whiskey and thinking it was absolutely disgusting, but I persevered, as anyone who spends a lot of time
good
in
for
Scottish
you.
Shit.
Way to fight through it.
Exactly. And then two things happened at the same time, which was in about 2011-ish, my dad had this idea of, hey, we could put a whiskey distillery in these old farm buildings.
Oh, Dad.
And he actually wrote a small short business plan. And then in 2012, I had some time off from Bain for my own fun. And I said to my family, we keep talking about this idea of a distillery, but nodding and think about it. Maybe I could spend some time off that I've got anyway, writing a business plan. So I did, which was partly fun, partly boring. But the fun bit involved going on a trip to Islay to visit lots of whiskey distilleries, because I thought I'd never been to Islay. And obviously, it's a kind of whiskey mecca. And weirdly, at the same time, just prior to going to Islay, I tasted the first whiskey that I loved. And no, I cannot remember what it was because it didn't seem important at the time, but that was when I fell in love with the whiskey. And my husband, who I was going on this trip to Islay with, I'd said, don't worry, I'll drive. You can do all the whiskey tasting. I was then like, nope, you're going on the car insurance as well. And I shall be doing the whiskey tastings alongside you. So I went to Islay. I did the tour, and I think that was really when I got this kind of feeling of all these amazing old distilleries out there, but there's quite a lot of people focusing on the way that things have always been done and not how we could do this more sustainably, and whether there's also some fun we could have and other kind of innovative ways that we could make whiskey. And so that became the kind of germination of this idea that would many years later become Nick Nian.
Was there anyone Islay or post Islay, post your trip in the industry who mentored you or kind of chatted with you from within and said, gave you some tips, said this is the dumbest idea in the world or the greatest idea in the world?
Or a mixture of both.
Exactly. The easy answer is that Dr. Jim Swan was a very important part of the Nick Nian story. Yeah. The reason I paused is because I was trying to think, I think most of what he said was, this is the dumbest idea in the world. But he didn't say it of the overall. There was a lot of every kind of thing we wanted to do differently. I met a lot of don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. And I think that's the way with established industries. People don't like change. People will never recommend what they've not seen. You know, using organic barley is a great example. Jim Swan described that as an expensive waste of time. But he never said the overall idea was a waste of time. But I don't think he really honestly cared about that either. He definitely saw how many new distilleries there were coming through and how many ideas never even reached fruition. And he'd obviously been burnt by that a bit because we saw an email from him once where right at the bottom of the chain, if you scroll down, this was like him introducing us to a supplier. I can't remember who it was, but right at the bottom of the chain, he'd said when emailing this supplier for the first time, this one will really happen. Obviously, he had emailed them a lot of times with distilleries that had never happened. So I guess that showed that he had faith in us, whether he thought it was a good idea or not. Aside from the specifics like organic barley and a cooling pond and things, he never opined. He was, I think, far too polite for that.
Well, Dr. Swan, his fingerprints are all over the industry, all over the world, right?
So yeah.
He's in many climates and many countries, and we come across his name so often, especially in the family of whiskeys that you're kind of connected to.
Yeah.
Right? From the Impex Bev.
What did you do? Penderin, M&H?
Yep.
What's the one in Australia? Did you Starboard or which one is it? What's the one in Australia?
Kilhoman.
Kilhoman, yeah. I don't know if he did Kilhoman. An Australian one. He did Kavalan.
Okay. Kavalan in Taiwan, yep. I think he did one of the Indian...
Something Shed. I think he did something.
I think he did Paul John.
There's a lot.
Paul John.
That's right. Paul John.
One. Yeah. Yep. Right. Loads of the Scottish ones. Mm. I mean, I say loads, probably four or five.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a cool, and I love the fact that Impex have so many of them in the portfolio. It's a great
They do.
Family from that sense.
Yeah.
Yep. We can mention the Impex connection here for a sec. We are grateful, as always, to Sam Filmus and Chris Udy for being such great partners of ours and sending us many samples over the years, including some of yours in the past. And they're here in California, so I'm close to those guys. And they are just so great in promoting their brands and their family of whiskeys and rums and other spirits. So hi, guys out there. Hi Chris. Hi Sam.
Hi, Chris and Sam.
And Jeanette, so there's a nice Jeanette. Never forget Jeanette.
That's
or
right.
Helen.
Never forget Jeanette.
If it wasn't for Jeanette and Helen, none of our whiskey would ever get to the US.
Yeah.
There you go. Maybe before we chat some more about the distillery, why don't we actually pour some?
How's that? Good idea.
Brilliant.
I'm brilliant, right?
By the way. I don't know what you guys are drinking out of this morning, but you know, you could be using your really hard to see your nicotine glass.
I don't have one of those with me, so I'm jealous.
I think I have the old fashioned glass. I don't know if I have a Glen.
That's what I have.
Oh, that have. One. Yeah. That's just see. For mixed drinks.
I was
to bring mine to the shore. I thought I'd break it in transit. It was all I could do to keep the samples from being broken.
We could talk packaging at some point too, but the packaging is just, you know, it's so simple. It's so nice. I can't see around it, you know.
I love the
bottle too, but I meant just the box for the
labels.
for the glass is very, you know, I'm not going to throw it away, but I don't recycle it because it's too cool.
So we have three whiskeys, right? So we have the Huntress Tea Cake, we have the Quiet Rebels Simon, and then we have the Ex Amarone Single Cask. Which are we doing first?
Huntress Malted Tea Cake.
Okay, sounds good.
Got it.
That sounds sounds like an entry point.
We're gonna pour a little cheers.
A little cheers.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no toast, just a cheers. Just cheers. We keep it simple.
Oh, did you hear that?
I did hear that.
And if we get a glug glug, that'd be better.
This bottle's actually too empty. Bottle kill.
No, no bottle kill. But we'll
Sunday on a Sunday.
The man down. That's good.
A report.
Report.
I am bored.
All right. Well, cheers, folks.
Cheers. Thanks again, Adam, for coming on. Thanks to Sam and Company for samples. So tell us, before we jump in too far, about this specific expression.
So Huntress is, so we're going to taste both of our limited edition series, and they both come out once a year, Huntress and Quiet Rebels. Huntress comes out in spring in the UK, and it normally lands, well, I mean, it's literally landed in the States about a month ago, Malta Tea Cake. So you're some of the first people to try it. It launched on our web shop last week. So Huntress is all about the experimental side of what we do. My observation, I guess, as an outsider coming into Scotch, was that there was a lot of focus on the way things had always been done, but not a lot of focus on what could be done. And I've always loved craft beer, and I'd always noticed how much craft breweries focused on yeast. And whiskey is, after all, just distilled beer. So when we started distilling, I really wanted to introduce different yeast strains into the process and see what impact they had on the flavour. And it's one of the most fun bits that we do. We actually produce these three different recipes of spirit within the year. We have a long maturation recipe. We have a short maturation recipe, which is most of what we produce. And then we have these weeks set aside for experimental production. And for the first few years, in fact, until about 2022, all of that experimental production was about different yeast strains. So we would take literally buckets and we would get yeasts recommended by our suppliers, or just ones that we liked the sound of, and combine them with our existing yeast in different proportions, experiment at bucket size, and then the ones that we like the taste of, scale up to the distillery. And so most of our Huntress editions have been focused on this. The naming of our Huntress series is all about the taste. So this is called Malted Tea Cake, and that is because it tastes like a malted tea cake. So it's lovely and sweet, like fig jam, kind of nice bready notes. And this was made with a Belgian ale.
Stop talking about food.
I know.
It is so...
Our Huntress also have food pairings, which is also part of the delight. And so if you come to the distillery this year and you're served, when you're served Huntress malted tea cake, you will get a bit of buttered malt loaf to go with it. And it is just wild. We actually had Mary from Impex at the distillery basically a week ago. And she was like, that is the best whiskey and food pairing I have ever had.
It is lovely.
So these, so this was a yeast trial that we ran in 2022. And we used our two normal yeasts and paired it with a third yeast called Double Trouble, which is a strain typically used for brewing Belgian style ale yeasts, Dubel. And that, yeah, it's really young. So it was, you know, 3 years old basically when we bottled it, and it's totally delicious, I think.
It is. Wow. It is.
Like a lot of honey on the nose.
Lots of honey. There's lots of wonderful sweet notes to it.
I'm getting like some honey and peaches. Or peach.
Exactly. And if you think, you guys have all tried McNean Organic, our flagship, the cask mix is basically the same as that. This is younger than that, because McNean Organic now has 3 to 9 year old barrels in it. But otherwise, the cask mix is basically the same. And so the difference is just the yeast.
That's really cool. Put this into a jam.
Ooh, yeah, that would be good. That would be really good. Or in a cheese.
This is delicious. Yeah, just something I can spoon out of. I'm not going to spread it or anything. I just want to eat
right out of the bowl.
Like an animal.
Like normal. With peanut butter?
Well, you joke about the cheese, but actually we have tried it with Isle of Mull cheddar, which is obviously just across the water from us, and is this like super salty, delicious thing. And it does work really well with that.
When I was in Scotland the first time on a trip with I'm sure you know Jason and Joshua from Single Cast Nation.
Mm-hmm.
We were, I don't know where we stopped, someplace on the road. I don't remember where we were. Somewhere in Speyside. And there was a little shop, the Spey Larder. That was the shop. I don't remember the name. And they had various cheeses that were infused with whiskey. And there was a, I don't remember the cheese, but there was one of the Lafroy cheese. That was my lunch. It was so freaking good. Imagine just whiskey, just cheese with a whiskey component to it. Just so good. I don't know how you do that, but it was good.
Big fan of cheese and whiskey.
Yeah.
Together, yeah. Yes, most definitely. Yeah, yeah.
Cheese and
just
chocolate.
Cheese and chocolate.
Cheese and chocolate. Yeah. Either one.
So
they both work.
You brought up a really interesting conversation, which I think we've talked about in the past. And it makes me think of Westlyn Distillery in Seattle. Mm-hmm. Matt Hoffman, when he was there, they were kind of on the cutting edge of single malt, American single malt, and doing something different. Not the only ones, but thinking about the way the breweries work in America. And they're way, way more experimental than the distilleries in America. And all the distilleries use generic yeast, the same barley all the time, and it's, you know, not much changes. And they started, you know, playing with concoctions of different yeast strains, different kinds of barleys. Balcones back even before that was using all kinds of different kinds of barleys, you know, in that are from the American Southwest. And it's like a recipe, right? You're just if you change the components, you're going to get a different cake. Right,
exactly.
In the brewer's defense, though, I mean, it's a much shorter game. You know, 30 days versus, you know, the much longer, much more expensive game of making whiskey.
This is true. This is true. Yes.
So you know, you can play around a little more with beer. I think not that it's not expensive because you still have to buy the barley and do all the cleaning.
No, I think you can argue it both ways. The alternative would be to say that if you brew a disgusting beer and you're just a brewery, what the hell are you going to do? Whereas if you brew a disgusting whiskey or wash, A, you distill it, which, you know, covers all manner of sins. But most importantly, you can just put it in a cask for a really long time.
And see what happens. That's right.
And see what happens. And then you can blend it into other stuff. So
right. When you're done with the beer, you're done with the beer. Exactly. You know it's bad right then. You can't do anything with it except...
Well, I meant more that, like, with beer, at least if you play around, you'll know sooner what the end result is versus with a whiskey.
Yes.
Well, to some extent, but we actually taste the wash. And this is something that I feel is slightly lost in whiskey, is that wash gives you an indicator. Obviously, I can't tell you exactly how it's going to turn out, but it gives you a pretty good indicator of what's going to happen down the process. So
garbage in, garbage out. So if it's good going in.
Yeah, if it tastes... Exactly. If it tastes disgusting, and that's why we do it in these small buckets, because also we measure the alcohol, because some yeast fight. And so if you put a yeast in and it doesn't make enough alcohol, you've got a problem. But, you know, we taste the wash, and we weren't very good at this, honestly, to begin with, because it wasn't something we had anyone in the team who had experience of seeing how wash developed into spirit, which developed into whiskey. But over time, we've understood how those things translate, and yeah, you can sort of see where it's going.
Okay. Well, that's actually, it's good that you mentioned that, because now I want to ask, what's your hand in actually the making of the whiskey? Or are you the evil finance person like all of us?
Somewhere in between.
Somewhere in between. Okay.
I mean, I do everything and nothing, I think would be a great description of my role.
It's like me.
I have the privilege of setting the vision and vetoing things that I don't like. But I don't do the blending, because if I did the blending, I wouldn't do anything else. So our blender is called Matt. And for something like Nicknian Organic, which is our flagship expression, we have agreed on what we want that to look like. And I trust him just to go off and do it. But for our limited editions, I'll always taste it before we sign off on the final blend. And for the more experimental stuff that we do, so since this yeast trial, actually, we've done even more experimental things. So we've done these long 2-week fermentations, for example, and that's something that I will be very actively involved in and collaborate with Matt and our distillery manager to make happen. But it's rarely me tasting the 100 cask samples to make the final blend.
Are you at the distillery every day?
No, I actually live in London. So I'm at the distillery in theory once a month, although since the beginning of June, I've been there 4 times. So June and July have been extremely busy. I've been up and down like a yo-yo, but no, I still live in London. It's where my husband's job is. And it makes it much easier for me to come to places like the States and visit you lovely people and pop to Paris for a day or two. So it's worked out okay from that point of view as well.
So should we get into the sustainability quotient to all this? We want to talk. I know this is near and dear to your heart, and it's the DNA of this place. By the way, let me go back for 1 second. So was your dad had this great idea, right? Hey, I got this great idea. I'm going to write something on paper. We're going to build a distillery, Dad. And we're going to make all this whiskey. Did he know anything about making whiskey? This is great. I love it.
No, he knew. He knew at the beginning as little as I did, and now a lot less than I do.
He's maintained his level of knowledge. That's good.
Our kids should know more than us. Yes.
Exactly. No, the irony, though, is that part of what got him excited about this idea was that at the time he was chair of something called the Drinkaware Trust, which is the UK kind of trade body. It's got trade members responsible for trying to encourage responsible drinking. And it was out of this. And he came to that as like an outsider. They wanted a kind of neutral chair that wasn't in the industry. And so as part of this role, trying to reduce people's alcohol consumption, came this idea to set up a whiskey distillery.
The motto should be drink less, but drink better.
Well, I mean, basically, that's what we're trying to do, right? And actually, out of that, you asked at the beginning, Aaron, whether there was anyone that had mentored me. And Jim Swan was really important. But there's also a guy called Bennett Slay, who's still our chairman. And he's been involved since day zero as well. He actually sat on that Drinkaware committee with my dad, and he'd spent God knows how long in Diageo. He was the ins and outs of the kind of, he was the behind the scenes unglamorous bit of the industry, if you like. And he has been very much the kind of shoulder to cry on, and also person to correct our way of travel.
A mentor or someone to
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
That's great. Okay, let's talk.
Can we call Spirit Guide?
Spirit Guide. Oh, Michael, very good, Michael. Can we cut his feet off right now?
Back to the green room.
that's the worst. Okay, let's get to the DNA. Let's get to the heart of what you envision for this distillery, which is the sustainability aspect of it. I've read a lot of articles about you and about the distillery. It is the through line through everything that goes on there.
Yeah, so I guess this came from two places, really. One was an observation that no one else seemed to be doing anything about the question of sustainability. And while I was at my strategy consulting firm, I had spent a year with a company called Innocent, who are a smoothie company based in the UK. And they had been one of the first, what I would now describe as purpose-led brands in the UK. That's now a very common thing, but when they started, it was an unknown thing. And their whole ethos was that business can be a force for good. Like, it's not a trade-off between, it's not you're either trying to make profit or you're a charity. Their whole ethos was that business can do good, and it's like this center ground. And that was really eye-opening to me, because certainly as a strategy consultant, I had only ever seen the big, big, big corporates with a share price that they cared about, and that was all they cared about. So that was very inspiring for me. And then when I looked into the whiskey industry, I felt like there was not that many people doing that at the time. It was quite traditional, and certainly no one was thinking about sustainability. And it doesn't take a genius to walk into a whiskey distillery and just realize that A, it's an agricultural product, and B, it uses a lot of energy. So it felt like there were things that needed addressing, and there wasn't anyone thinking about it. So I wanted to show that whiskey could be and needed to be made in a more sustainable way. But I also, you know, wanted to make this kind of innovative, different whiskey. And I felt that I couldn't, you know, go to bed peacefully at night if I didn't do that sustainably, because let's be honest, no one needs another Scotch whiskey distillery. There are enough out there. So if you're going to create a new one, you kind of have to do it in the best way possible, just from a moral baseline. So yeah, those were the two motivating reasons for it, I think. But I hope also, and part of our bigger mission is to get more people into whiskey. I think it's such an amazing product, such an amazing tradition. And definitely in the UK, there's a bit of a reticence for the younger generation to drink whiskey. There's a feeling that it's a bit old school. And hopefully by talking and addressing things like sustainability, we can say this is a product or a distillery or whatever it is for you.
So when you're setting up, you don't know anything about making whiskey. You come up with this plan. How do you, aside from walking through distilleries and looking and saying, that looks like we probably don't need, I don't know, some big electric generator over here. We could do something better. What's your thought process on how do I make this thing I don't understand very well, make it more sustainable? Does that make sense? I mean,
it does. It does.
If you look at a gas powered car, you don't know anything about energy. How do you even think about making it better for the environment?
And I think
if you don't know about making cars.
Exactly. I think the thing at least that I've learned as a consultant is that you can basically ask questions to get to the bottom of anything. But also, I mean, there's some things when you look at a whiskey distillery that are blindingly obvious. Energy, number one, you only have to stand next to the stills to realize how energy intensive it is. Agriculture, also obvious. And water, also pretty obvious. So I tried to address each of those in the way we set Nick Nian up. So from an energy point of view, we use 100% renewable energy. And for that, we've chosen biomass, i.e. timber, which is that's right next door to the distillery. From an agricultural point of view, we buy organic barley from Scotland, which surprisingly enough, a lot of the distilleries do not buy barley from Scotland anymore because there's not enough grown in Scotland. And we have tried to be as conservative as possible with water. I would say that with every one of those choices, we've been told, that's a silly idea, don't do it. But that is the reality of trying to do things differently. And the interesting thing is, if you really look at it, a lot of the ways that we're doing it is not so different to the way it had been done 100 or 150 years ago. People were using things like wood or whatever was at their disposal to fire their distilleries. All crops before the Second World War were grown organically. And from a water point of view, they'd have done whatever it took to conserve the water they had. So I just looked at each of those components and thought, what's the best way we can do it? From a water point of view, we have a cooling pond, which is just a closed loop system that circulates through the distillery. And we were told it wouldn't work. It's a stupid idea. You know, you should just put in a cooling tower, and you just have to have the confidence to say, there's got to be a better way of doing things sometimes and go for it. And we've been proved right. Like, we put in these subcoolers with electric heat exchangers in case the cooling pond wasn't cold enough, and we've never used them.
Where are you on your goal of whatever your goal is in terms of sustainability? Are you there? Have you reached it? Is there more to do, or is there always more to do?
Oh, there is always more to do. I dream of the day when there is not more to do. I think from a point of view of what we do on site, we're in a really good place. We have absolutely minimized the emissions coming off the site at Nick Nian, but things like our bottles, which, by the way, was the one bit I didn't have to think of at the beginning. The brilliant thing about a whiskey distillery is it's long-term enough that you've got some time to plan these things. We were the first to launch into 100% recycled glass. And the reason we chose that is because the carbon emissions of recycled glass are 40% lower than normal glass. But it's still made with fossil fuels. The remaining emissions are fossil fuel emissions, and we are not really in a position to be able to drive the change in the glass making industry to mitigate that at the moment. We're not big enough, and we can ask all of those questions of our suppliers. And to be fair, our suppliers are amazing and they are already thinking about it. It's a really hard problem to solve. So there is always more to do.
Well, you can only do so much, right? Without going totally crazy and still sustaining a business.
Ooh.
There's two kinds of sustainabilities, right? You have to sustain the business. You got to keep going.
Absolutely.
You can only
exactly.
do so much, right? Yep.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. And I always say, we have a kind of internal decision matrix that we use where we assess, whatever it is it a new T-shirt or a new bottle or whatever? We have a decision matrix that we use that assesses the sustainability of whatever it is we're buying against the functionality of whatever it is we're buying and the cost of whatever it is we're buying. And yes, we of course always want to choose the most sustainable option, but it's, if it's 15 times the price, it's not practical.
Yeah. You gotta be able to sell it, right?
It's not sustainable.
It's not sustainable in that sense of the word.
Exactly.
Exactly.
It really is.
Yeah. I mean, if you have to close your doors to save a couple of bucks, it's not gonna work.
Nope.
Exactly.
Well, on that note, why don't we go into our second whiskey and then we're gonna chat about a certain television show. How's that?
Sure.
Right. I'm excited about the television show and the whiskey.
Sounds like a plan.
This is good with the sustainability conversation.
Exactly.
And running a business. It'll all blend nicely.
It will.
Like the whiskey.
There's a reason I love this television show.
So this is the Quiet Rebels Simon Single Malt. Right?
That's the one.
I have to say, kind of the way this started, I think I said earlier that I was in London with my family like 6 weeks ago. And I happened to go into the Whiskey Exchange. And not ever been to one of their locations. And I was pleasantly surprised to find a wonderful display of your whiskeys and your local rep. I cannot remember his name.
Tyler.
And a nice Canadian chap. And yeah,
with a very impressive beard.
A very impressive beard. I was very impressed. And we chatted whiskey and common folks that we know and chatted all that you guys are doing. And that ultimately led to this podcast here today. And what I was really impressed, I have some pictures in my phone of all the bottles and all the packaging. It's just beautiful. They're just, being here in the States, we don't see everything, right? That gets, there's things in Europe, right, that we don't get to see here. And I was just, wait, I thought there's only this. I didn't know. Or whatever Sam has sent us, a couple samples. We never see the bottle. And then all of a sudden, there's all these bottles and these cool tins. And oh my God, it was gorgeous. Absolutely. And there was like this color coding, as I recall, between the single cask ones and the non-single cask ones. Was there like a different packaging a little bit?
Yeah, they're all in different packaging. So the Quiet Rebels one, I've got this kind of tube.
Look at that.
The Huntress.
Mike, you see that? Look at that, Mike.
This tube.
This is Mike's world. Mike's
and
excited.
Then the Oons, which is our single cast, we'll come on to.
Look at that.
Oh, this camera is like this.
All the pretty shiny packaging.
So I nice. Know. That's Mike. Oh, this is very. It was very cool. It's cool to see them all in one spot. So, okay. On to Quiet Rebels. Tell us about that.
So Quiet Rebels is our other limited edition. So this comes out in Europe in autumn time, generally gets to the States, kind of depends how quick the shipping is, but November, maybe January. And this series is all about celebrating our team. And we talked about the importance of sustainability as a business and sustainability from a planetary point of view. But I think the people side of things is also often missed. And treating people right and that whole people side is a really important part of our business. And actually it goes all the way back to kind of our origins. And one of the reasons my dad had this idea of setting up a whiskey distillery in these old farm buildings was to create employment in the local area. So we are right up on the west coast of Scotland. We are really in the middle of nowhere. And it doesn't matter how much I tell people we're in the middle of nowhere until they come. And then they say, oh, my God, you're really in the middle of nowhere. And
we're past nowhere.
We're beyond that. Exactly.
When you get to nowhere, you're not even close to where we are.
Nowhere adjacent.
Yes. So you actually do get to this town called Lochalan. It has 350 people in it. It's got a shop, a petrol station, an excellent restaurant, which is rather surprising and delicious, and a sand mine. And that's basically it. And then you turn right and you drive for 11 miles along a single track road. And then the road ends and you go onto a gravel track and you drive for another mile and a half and then you find the distillery. So that is how much we're in the middle of nowhere. Hmm. And
you ever get mail? Does the post person ever come?
Of course, it's too much work. The UK. No, we get mail every day.
They just give up.
They're like, do they charge you more for that mail? That's
right.
Yes.
They Royal leave it at the good restaurant. We're not going anywhere.
Exactly, but the couriers charge us more, of course. But one of the things we wanted to do with Nickname was create sustainable, skilled, year-round, long-term jobs to bring or keep young people in the area. And this seemed to me, this was very much my dad's focus. I was more focused on the kind of environmental sustainability side. And this seemed to me highly theoretical at the beginning, but it's been really awesome to see the impact it's had. So we now employ 10 people up there. But it's not only the 10 people we employ, right? There's also other businesses that benefit from us being there because we've increased tourism to the area and so on and so forth. Anyway, suffice to say, people is a really important part of what we do. And the Quiet Rebel series is all about celebrating those people. So you get your name on the front of the Quiet Rebels bottle in the order that you join the company, which is also a great way to motivate people to stay. And when it's your turn, you get to sit down with Matt, our blender, and discuss what is your kind of perfect whiskey. And then we try and create that perfect whiskey as much as we can. So this series tends to focus more on cask finishes because we're always working like 12 months or so out. And the one that we are trying today is Quiet Rebel Simon. So Simon is one of our distillers. He joined us in 2019. He's an ex-chef. He is, as well as one of our distillers, he's also one of our tour guides. He runs our warehouse and he's also our beekeeper. Everyone at Nian has a minimum of 4 roles. And he...
Yes, chef.
Exactly. Well, when the Impex team came to visit us last year and when Mary came last week, he cooks pizzas for everybody because his pizzas are amazing. And when Chris and Sam came, they were like, it's quite bold to cook pizzas for a whole load of Americans. So I was like, I hadn't actually considered that. But they all agreed they were absolutely excellent and some of the best food they had on their whole trip to Scotland. So Simon, everyone's Quiet Rebels is very different in terms of the way they think about whiskey, the way they understand it, and the way they want to, I guess, create their Quiet Rebels. Simon was very clear. He absolutely loves beer and he wanted a stout cask finish. That was very clear in his mind. Also, of all the casks that we use, he particularly loves our STR red wine casks. So the way that we created Quiet Rebel Simon was to take a whole load of STR casks that we had just emptied for one of our Nickname organic batches, send those STR casks down to Innocent Gun, who are a Scottish craft brewer known for their cask.
You answered my next question.
There you go. They brewed us a special oatmeal stout just for this, which
they make good beer.
They filled that oatmeal stout into the STR cask we sent down. They kept it in there for 3 months. They then emptied the beer, which was excellent, and we got lots of it back up to the distillery, which was fun, and sent us the empty cask back up. And we then put more STR cask whiskey that had been in different STR casks into those beer conditioned casks or stout conditioned casks, but only for 3 weeks. So it was an incredibly short finish. But we had done a previous experiment by kind of creating a kind of pseudo cask, if you like. And we had kept it in there for 6 weeks and we decided in that process that 3 weeks was the optimum. So That's how Quiet Rebel Simon came to me. And for me, so this is a singular cask type, if you like, which is reasonably rare for us in our limited editions. We're normally using multiple cask types. And yeah, I just think it's very, very chocolatey, very rich.
Yeah, instead of getting the honey like we had with the first one, you get more of that chocolate and maybe a little oaky.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not got the honeyed sweetness of malted tea cake, that's for sure.
Yeah, the first taste, I got like almost like a little tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We can mention that STR cask is
shaved, toasted, recharged.
From Dr. Swan, right?
Exactly.
The man behind that, right?
Exactly. This is a classic Jim Swan cask. He basically invented it. And yeah, as you said, they're shaved, toasted, and recharred Spanish red wine casks. So it's American oak. The casks have had Spanish red wine in for 3 to 5 to a bit more years. Once the red wine is done with them, they are shaved, so a bit taken off the inside, toasted, heated, and recharred. And that charring process caramelizes the red wine sugars, so you don't get the kind of typical red wine finish that people might have tried. So it doesn't produce a red whiskey. It has no tannins. But that STRing process creates lots of kind of red fruit characteristics and spice. And it's a really important part of what we do. And Jim, the marrying of those STR casks with bourbon was a very important part of Jim's philosophy, I think.
Yep, definitely.
So the first one I wanted to have on my toast with breakfast, and this one I want to have with dessert.
Mm.
I need to get one for in between. This would be
maybe that's the next one.
We're coming.
This would be delicious with dessert. This is really nice.
And the first one wouldn't? I mean,
no, it was jammy. You start your day with it. That's a day starter.
The breakfast whiskey. Breakfast whiskey. Okay.
Exactly.
I got you.
Okay. Just a reminder, this is what we watch when we drink. We have a very special episode here on a Sunday with Annabelle Thomas from Nicknean Distillery in Scotland. And as I recall, you're kind of looking over at Tobermory, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. I'm a little mole over there. Yep.
Yep. We are literally, if you have a boat, 10 minutes by boat to Tobermory.
There you go. Okay, so the other half of this nonsense that we do is we talk about television and things that we're watching, movies and such. And when this whole conversation started by email, we usually ask our guests for thoughts on what they would like to watch. And Annabelle came up with, I believe you came up with this, a show that's on here on Amazon Prime. I don't know where it was in the rest of the world originally. Jeremy Clarkson is the host of this thing. It's Clarkson's Farm. And you have a little synopsis,
a little
of it?
Blurb.
A blurb, as we say.
They keep it pretty simple on IMDb. Follow Jeremy Clarkson as he attempts to run a farm in the countryside.
That's pretty much it. So Jeremy Clarkson, probably everyone in the world knows him. Top long gear. Time. You guys say presenter, I believe, in the UK. We would call him a host here in the States. Various shows, right? And a star, you know, host is kind of funny because he's really a star of shows. And what was the racing one? And you guys,
Top Gear.
For years. And then the follow up to that was
the Grand Tour.
Right? Yes. So he's a little bit larger than life. Can we say that, right?
And he's a big guy.
Yes, he's a big guy. Probably about our age. Okay, there you go. So I don't know. I don't remember the how this came about, but in reality TV, they come about in the weirdest ways. But someone got the idea to follow along with him as he learns the art of farming on his own farm. That's the gist of it. In every episode,
I would bet that it was Clarkson who had the idea.
You're probably right.
And he thought it was a good idea.
Yes.
And he thought it was a good idea. Yes.
A lot about him.
Well,
yes.
You know, good television. That's what matters.
So we're in New Jersey, and we're the Garden State. And at any point in time, you drive along and you'll see large sections for sale, because a family has no longer, you know, third, fourth generation has said, we don't want to be farmers anymore. They're going to sell land. And my children and I will drive past and they'll be like, what if we bought that? And I keep saying, what are we going to do with that?
I
don't know. We could buy that.
Keep going.
And my son just said, what if we grew like rye? I was like, why would we grow rye? Oh, we can make whiskey. It's like, do you have any idea how much rye you would have to grow to make whiskey? No. And I'm thinking, this is what happened to Jeremy Clarkson.
This is
a great idea.
Zero.
Nothing.
What we learned from the show is that farming is actual work, like work. W-O-R-K work, not the stuff that we do.
Yes.
Correct. Making whiskey farmers is actual work.
It is. Farmers get up early in the morning and they go to bed really late. And it's endless. It is never.
And they do all the work themselves.
Yep.
And if you are coming in from non-farming world, it is
like London. Yeah,
like London, like never being in a field in your life,
like an office.
Yeah.
yes. Now, this is a classic fish out of water story, right? Mm-hmm. He is not used to being outside of his bubble, wherever the bubble might be, except a Jaguar or a Lamborghini or something. Lamborghini. And he tries to, and of course that's the gist of the whole show, is that he tries to come up with great ideas that are unsustainable and throw money at things to make them work. And usually they don't. We had a show in the 1960s here, a sitcom, called Green Acres. And it was about this, do you know this, Annabelle? It was about a couple from New York City, an attorney and his wife who wore, one of the Gabors, sisters. And she wore wonderful gowns and he wore always in a tuxedo or ready to go into court. And he decides to throw it all away, their big Manhattan apartment, and move to, actually California, and buy a farm and become a farmer. No idea what he's doing. Total fish out of water, and all the locals think he's nuts. And it's the same story. And he thinks he can learn all this on his own, and he drives his tractor in his three-piece suit, and his house is falling apart, and the locals just think he's crazy, and he can't ever seem to get things rolling. But he won't give up. And I guess that's the story here. Granted, it's for TV, and this is a business, but Jeremy Clarkson won't give up. I think the series went to 5 seasons.
Still going.
I watched the entire first season. Obviously, Annabelle, you're caught up.
I'm way on.
Mike, you watched the first season?
Yep.
The first season is pretty wild, and I love the fact that every episode is a gerund. Every name is shearing. Sheeping, plowing, whatever they are. That's the name of the episode. And you see him learn that thing. Oh, and I should add, this is kind of important to the story, is that first season happens during COVID, which makes it even more difficult. And I can't imagine, much like where your distillery is, middle of nowhere. He's not in the middle of nowhere. He's in the Cotswolds, right? Totally the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's, I don't know, an hour from London or so.
It's definitely not the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. But it's farmland. It's not. It's his nowhere. He doesn't know where. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It seems like a pretty nice place. You know, the farmhouse or his home there, it looks pretty nice. But he's up against all of the things that many of us went up against during COVID, all of the restrictions and how to get things done. And he's learning this new job and trying to make it sustainable and profitable. It's difficult. And of course, putting him in situations where he's almost doomed to fail, like, helping lambing, like that was, and then there's some realities of watching, sheep being born and sheep mating and et cetera, that are a little hard to watch and also hard for him to be a part of, which is fun, funny, and difficult too. Thoughts, anyone on the show? On
you didn't mention the name of the farm.
Oh, it's
Diddley Squat.
Diddley Squat.
That's, that's what he knows about farming. So he renames a farm Diddley Squat, which I think that sums up pretty much how this is going to go.
I love the first episode where he brings in that Lamborghini tractor.
Oh, the tractor. Yeah. Like, he tried the Top Gear.
Like,
it just didn't work.
Oh, my God. Yeah, and of course, it's too big for the shed. It's too wide. It's too much. And his farmhand, like Ebb on Green Acres, basically tells him, you know, this is dumb. What are you doing? This is stupid. What's wrong with the little red tractor we have here already that's like 50 years old? It'll work. But he has to do everything differently. He thinks he's smarter than everybody else. And you can see, running contrary to Annabelle's theories, he kind of disdains lots of things about sustainability. He wants to, he wants the shortcuts. He wants to get to the end faster, right? And environment be damned. Not totally environment be damned, but he would
But he doesn't care very much about it, I would say.
Does not. Yes. No. And hates all the regulations involved in the local community. His opening of his little farm store, which was only allowed if he sells product from within the county, the local area, which is, you know, say what you want about that, but, you know, it's more rules that he has to kind of deal with, and he doesn't want to. And during COVID, where you can't have people coming into the building or have to have social distancing, et cetera, as we, that seems so long ago. Those terms are so funny hearing now. But yeah, isn't it? And masking and such. And he, like yourself, has to deal with all the normal things that farmers do, like the lack of rain or too much rain or the weather just changing on a dime and you can't do something because it's wet out and you can't do something, or you're not getting enough water to portion A of your parcel A of your farm. It's not easy. You know this. You know exactly what this is all about, right?
Yeah. Although I would say that, I mean, distilling whiskey is hard enough, but it ain't nearly as hard as actually farming. So.
Yeah. Oh, sure, sure. Yes. Well, you're like one tiny segment.
Once you get the grain, it's kind of controlled, right?
Absolutely. Exactly.
Yeah. So for him, getting the grain is the hard part, right? Because you got to get the ground ready. You got to plant. You got to wait for rain and then wait for it to grow and then harvest it all. That takes a while.
You know, it was interesting.
And then sell really it.
What I never gave any thought was the fact that they had to wait for the soil to be at a certain moisture before they could harvest. Uh-huh. I was like, oh, okay. I know nothing about this.
What's the name
cool
of the
harvester?
Oh, those are cool. Those are cool. Yes.
How cool is that? Don't get too close.
Combine machine is pretty awesome. Ooh. What's the name of the kid that works?
That's my job. That's my
Caleb.
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 We need a show. We need a Caleb spinoff.
He doesn't need a spinoff. He is the show.
I mean, this is why there are so many aspects to this show, and that's why I think it's so fascinating. There's the like basic storyline, which is man who knows piss all goes to be a farmer, but there's like everything else around it, and Caleb has become a celebrity in his own right in the UK.
Oh, that's great.
And he has made, and who knows what the financial arrangements are for the show itself, but he's written I think 2 books, and he was genuinely a normal farmhand before this, and now he must be a multimillionaire, and I think that is really cool. So there's lots of other bits of the show, by the way, which I think are not really cool, but that in itself, I think, is just amazing.
He might not mind London so much anymore.
I suspect he still does, but
no, maybe.
There's so many episodes that are so funny in that with him, his own little segments, going to driving into London to sell wasabi.
The horseradish. Exactly.
And he's told by Clarkson, you have to sell this for £300. I remember £300 per root or something. And he goes, the first place he goes to is Nobu. And how he gets into Nobu is, and he can't figure out, you know, his car is talking to him. I had the same experience driving through Glasgow myself. And my car is telling me to go on the second turn out on the roundabout and make a left and make a right. And you're like, wow, I'm going crazy here. And there's nobody driving. It's COVID. There's no cars on the road hardly. Yet he hasn't been driving in London before, and he's stressing out, and he gets a parking ticket. And it's so funny. And then he goes, and nobody won't buy it from him. The next place he goes to, they'll give him like £7, not £300. Big difference. So he's already lost money because he's got a ticket, and he's not selling any of the wasabi because it's not good enough. Or I don't know what's wrong with it. And that was, of course, that was Clarkson's great idea. Hey, let's grow wasabi. This is awesome. This is a great idea. Nobody has real fresh wasabi. They all use fake wasabi. They use fake, you know, colored horseradish. He's great. He is. I'm glad to hear that he's got. There's a Caleb industry going on. That's wonderful. Oh,
there absolutely is. Exactly.
Now, without giving too much away, do we know much more about? Is it John, the other helping hand, the guy who you can't understand
at all? Oh, Gerald.
Gerald.
That's the guy you can't understand.
I mean,
you can't. He's like, well, Clarkson just, the looks are just, he has no idea what he's saying.
But I mean, that is, I mean, you guys must think it's even harder to understand than I do, but.
Yes. Well, it reminds me of being in Scotland the first time. You know, you're talking to just local anyway.
But I can understand people in Scotland, but I cannot understand him. He is absolutely comedy gold, isn't he? I don't know where they found these characters from, because I'm pretty sure that on a typical Cotswolds farm, you do not have a Caleb, a cheerful Charlie, and a, what's he called?
Yes. There's only the three of them. And his wife, I think.
He's got the shepherdess, too. Yeah, it's a shepherd.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah.
Who's great. She's really good, too.
Well, it's funny on so many levels, because really, it's a fish out of water. He doesn't know what he's doing, and he tries to better the situation by coming up with these crazy ideas. And of course, that's reality TV. It's reality, except it's scripted in many, many ways.
Yeah, using a drone to herd sheep. I mean, that's pretty funny.
Yes. Well,
you can't AI your way out of herding sheep, can you?
No. You know, some of his ideas are not totally crazy. They're just not completely well thought out.
Not well executed,
yes. Because you probably could take the drone idea and make it work. You probably could take a lot of these ideas and make them work if you're not trying to do them overnight. A little engineering involved, a little architecture.
My son spent his senior year at the University of Delaware working for a agricultural professor building a robot to harvest watermelons. So
there you go.
You can AI things.
Can
They're
be
just
done.
Not successful as you hope they would
make
be.
It work. No,
did you guys, I can't remember if this is in the first series or not. Have you got the BlackBerry vacuum cleaner?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think so.
In one of the next, maybe it's in the second series, but they have all of these. I think it's in one of the later series, Caleb and Jeremy decide to split the farm in two. And Caleb tries traditional farming on his bit, and Jeremy tries basically non-traditional farming on his bit. And one of Jeremy's ideas to make money out of his bit that isn't farmable is to harvest blackberries, which is not a silly idea because there's a hell of a lot of blackberries in the English countryside. And so he trials. And this is sort of the genius and also the bit about the show. He brings in this blackberry harvester from like a professional blackberry harvesting tech company, which sort of mows down an old stone wall, and it's all a disaster. And then Jeremy goes out on the back of a trailer pulled behind one of his tractors with a vacuum cleaner, and he just vacuums the blackberries off
I'm assuming it didn't go well.
Well, actually, no, the vacuuming went a lot better than the
And now he has a BlackBerry vacuuming company.
Probably products.
You know what was fun, and I don't know if they did it in other episodes of the first season, but I was watching the eighth episode with my son, and I hear the music going, and I'm like, you know, this music sounds familiar. Like I think they used that in Goodfellas, and then as they're cutting along, and they're cutting it like, I don't know if you've seen Goodfellas, but there's a whole scene where basically Ray Liotta's character is, you know, he's on a coke bend. He's trying to get rid of a bunch of drugs. He's like driving a Cadillac. He has like all these errands to do. And he's doing the same thing. So like he's got his brother making sauce. And then Jeremy Clarkson's trying to make tomato sauce. And then he's got all this crazy stuff going on. And he's got a helicopter following him the whole time. And it was kind of cut the same way as Goodfellas. And I'm just watching this. I'm like, what is going on? This just looks real familiar. So that was kind of, and I don't know if he did that in other episodes, if there were other homages to movies, but that particular one.
I don't know. Yeah, that's so interesting. I didn't pick that up, but I imagine
it took me a little bit because I hear the music. Yeah. I'm like, I know this music. And then it just kind of kept going. But it was pretty
cool. And ultimately, he's a businessman, and you know he's thinking about how to make this thing profitable from day one. Can I make this profitable? And his Charlie is his name keeps telling him, you know, you got to get this kind of yield, and you know you need to sell this for this, and you know you can't be underselling in the store. Blah blah blah. Throughout the show, and then at the very end of season one, he has to sit down after like about a year of having all this farming. He finds out that he's made a total of, 14 pounds over the entire year after spending all this money and selling all this stuff and going through all these headaches. He's made a whopping 14 pounds. And what the hell am I doing to and this is arguably what most small businesses have to go through, right? The first year, you lose money the first year. If you're, if you're lucky, you stay in business that long.
Yep.
And for him, who's a multimillionaire, he's like, what am I doing? I'm 60 something years old. I don't have to be doing this. I can go back to my mansion in London, and I don't need to do this.
Yep.
But his wife says, you know, you're really, he says, I really, I'm pretty happy here. And what's really funny is Caleb says, you should go back to London. You really should leave. You really, you're happier in London. Get out of here. And his wife says, yeah, you are happier, but you are happier here on the farm. And obviously he stays, and we know because there's multiple seasons. But that's typical, right? That is typical. You're after your first year.
Yeah.
Without talking about finances here, you probably going, what are we doing? I know you're looking long term.
I mean,
you know, you don't have so much money.
I hate to break it to you, but we're still thinking that.
There you go. Yes.
But you know what the cool, one of the coolest things about this show, I think, is that as 100% non-farmers, we can sit here and consider this good entertainment. But in the UK, at least, it has had massive support from real farmers. And that is one of the things that I think this show has managed to do so well, is showcase farmers' genuine struggles. And actually, that 14-pound profit thing, or whatever it was, is not just because it's the first year in business, because that's actually how hard farming in the UK is. And farmers are like, oh my God, I finally feel seen. Like some people out there appreciating how hard this is and what we go through every year and how reliant we are on the weather and yields and market prices and all these other things that are completely out of our control, and how dedicated we are to this patch of land. And I think to have made, there's many things I really hate about Jeremy Clarkson, but to have made a show where people can see it as just interesting, fun entertainment, and farmers can also appreciate it, I think is totally genius.
I totally agree with you. Yeah. And you know, we all who live in large cities, we walk in our grocery stores over the weekend, and we see this immense cornucopia of produce and meat and dairy products, and like it magically just shows up. It doesn't magically show up. Now, granted, in the States, farming is a very industrialized process. It's owned by very large companies. It's not all mom and pops that are running these small farms anymore. The industry is very different than it once was, but it still comes from a very small place, a piece, you know, ground or farm, a dairy, and somehow or other that egg, that watermelon, that bottle of milk, that chicken somehow gets to you. And we don't think about it enough.
No.
Right, we do not.
Yeah,
at
you
all.
Don't
we
appreciate
just know that it's there.
All the work that it takes to get into that. I mean, I went to our last local farm to pick up some stuff. If you want to get fresh strawberries in there, you've got about a 3-week window, and then it's gone. Then the rest of the strawberries are from Florida or California or
they're wherever. Coming out of the shipping terminal. Yeah,
same thing with everything else. You know, so
yep. And if you go to any of your
local states, were hit pretty hard with when bird flu hit. That the price of eggs went from $1 something a dozen to $8, and there was no hope in sight because you got to cull the herd. You got to cull.
That's it.
He, you know, he, on his show, when he has to deal with some of the stuff, and
we
really what happens with farmers. There's nothing you can do.
Highly recommend folks to go to their local farmers market, where you're actually talking to a local farmer, and they are bringing out their crop for the week of whatever it is, strawberries, eggs, whatever, and they're closer to Jeremy Clarkson than most of what you probably see in the grocery store. Yeah. Because that's all big farm.
Yeah.
Even the big farmer, they still have the subcontractors doing a lot of the stuff too. So
that's true. Yeah. That's true.
Everything we grow is bought by the big farm, but we're still the little farm making everything for big farm.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really wonderful to hear that the local farming community in the UK and or probably all of Europe appreciates what he brought, or probably inadvertently, he wasn't planning on that. And I hope he appreciates it too, that he came up with a reality show idea, but if there's a bigger picture here that he
maybe absolutely
stumbled into, you know,
exactly
brought farming to the forefront for folks who never thought about it, and the farmers should be appreciated. And
absolutely, exactly.
Yeah. It's a fun show. I wasn't sure. I was never a huge fan of him because he's so larger than life and annoying at certain times. And,
he's a little abrasive, maybe.
A little, maybe.
But in a fun way. I mean, you know, he's
like a Brillo.
But you know, he's just having fun with it. He's pushing buttons. He's, you know.
Oh, you know,
that's what he does.
He knows his character, and he knows. I'm sure off screen, he's probably not
that guy. He might be worse.
He knows television.
He's got this TV persona for 25 plus years, and he's not changing. He knows what works, and he's not going to be changing much. And that's what sells, right?
Yeah. You know, 20 years of
the Jeremy Clarkson
the show.
Yeah. And what, 5 or 6 seasons of this thing has been popular, right?
Mm.
So, yeah, and ongoing apparently. So
exactly.
I said I may not go back to it, but maybe I will go back to it. I think I'm more intrigued.
I would say that season 2 is definitely worthwhile. I would say that after that, season 1 to me, when what got me hooked is that the disasters felt relatively natural. I would say as the show progresses, the disasters start to feel slightly manufactured.
Yeah.
Like trying to open up a restaurant? Exactly. I didn't get that far yet. I just started the first episode, so.
But also, you know what's also interesting is that off the back of the show, he started a lager brand, a beer brand, and it's absolutely flying.
Huh.
So... Oh. Yeah, it's like 20 million. It's got 20 million already.
Is the brewery on site or is it somewhere else?
It's in the Cotswolds somewhere, but it uses his barley. So
that's great.
A value additive to his own product. And it's nearby. I can't remember where it is.
Well, you know, that's so funny because value added. So much of what he talks about in season 1 is what can we do to make whatever, this piece of land, this product have more value. That's the ongoing conversation he has. How do we make every part of this farm sustainable, but in a profitable way? And it's I'm sure every farmer kind of goes through that. You know, we've got this piece of, I just saw this here. You know, where did I see this? Something about farmers here are well, of course we have the whole, you know, the data center thing, but they're taking pieces of their land for completely different uses, right? I know what it was for solar farms. So they're you know, we're not growing anything on this half of this property. We should do something else with it. We can sell this off or rent it off to a solar company and put in a solar field, or wind field or whatever, windmills. And I'm sure he probably thinks these kinds of things as well, trying to the thing going, right? Somehow. Exactly. Fun show. Very fun show. Great idea. And it really has a nice connection to what you do.
Yeah, it does. And I think that's one of the reasons I enjoyed it, actually. Had any of you guys heard of it before?
Yeah. I watched it actually.
I'd heard of it.
Yeah.
Okay. So I watched it a couple years ago and I revisited it because a friend of mine recommended it. So I'm glad I did because I caught stuff I didn't catch the first time around. So
Yeah.
So I'd heard of it, but I didn't really know much of it.
It was
the first season's fun for sure.
Yeah.
We have one more whiskey to go.
Sadly.
Well, you could always go back around and do it again.
You can.
If you didn't drink it all.
Not if you finish them all.
So yeah. I'm assuming this is the single cask.
Yes, that's correct. And this, sadly for me, is the one that I don't have. But I've got a different single cask instead, so I'm fine.
So you'll be joining us.
I will be joining you. Just mine's a white port finish, and yours is an Amarone, so it's not so different.
So Amarone is an Italian wine, correct?
Correct, exactly.
Okay. It says cask 20.
But it's not a fortified wine, it's just a regular table wine.
That's correct.
Okay.
So this is, so all of our single casks are called Oon, which is spelled A-O-N. So I initially pronounced this Aeon, but you have to think of a Scottish person saying Oon in French, but with a Scottish accent, Oon. So that means one, obviously, in Gaelic. And so we chose that for the name of all of our single casks. This is an Amarone finish that was chosen specifically for Inpex, who we mentioned earlier, who are our wonderful US importers. The number on the bottle, all the bottles, is 2674, which means it was a 2020 cask and it was number 674. So this is a 2020 cask and it was bottled in 2025. So it's a five-year-old. It started off in ex-bourbon and then was finished in Amarone. And I have tasted this. I just don't have it with me right now. But like chocolatey and nutty were the vibes that I got from it when I tasted it. It's bottled at 57.1. So nice high strength. And yeah, want to know what you guys think of it while I explore this white port cask.
Question. Do you mature everything on site?
We mature nearly everything on site. So initially, pre-2020, I would have said yes. Then we needed to build another warehouse and COVID and other things, i.e. my poor planning, delayed that a little bit. And we ran out of space before the new warehouses were built. So we had to start storing stuff offsite in Glasgow. And then we built a new warehouse and we started putting stuff back in there. But what I realized in the process of storing things offsite is this is actually quite a good idea, because if everything at Lingnean burns down, and I say that previously sort of in jest, but the wildfires we've had in Europe have been absolutely horrendous in the last 2 weeks, and it's not merely a theoretical possibility. Yeah. It is an actual possibility.
And distilleries aren't dangerous.
No. Well, quite exactly. It's like, what about thousands of casks of high strength alcohol? It would obviously be completely devastating to the business if all of your stock goes at once. So having thought that this was merely a mitigation for the warehouses not being built in time, we have since decided that it's actually not a stupid idea. So long way of saying, almost all of our stock is on site in our Dunwich warehouses, but we do have a portion of it offsite in Glasgow. And at some, we sent a whole load offsite in 2020 and 2021. And we will probably do that again at some point in the future so that we have at least some stock available to us. Were the worst.
Do the offsite barrels come back to you for bottling, or do they?
They do, because we bottle everything on site. So that's the kind of awkward process. You send it all the way to Glasgow, which is not, it's not a long distance, but it's not a short journey. And then we bring back parcels of a whole lorry at once, and we'll re-rack them in our own warehouses to kind of settle, and then we'll start to integrate them.
All right, kids.
You know, I was expecting this to be a little vapory at 57, and it really is.
Oh, yeah, it's not. Not at all.
No. I mean, when you nose it, yes. When you taste it, it's not super hot.
I don't think it on the nose is very vapory.
A little bit.
You have a very sensitive nose.
I am. I'm a sensitive man. I'm very, very sensitive. But you said chocolate, and that's I get just chocolate. Oh, now, yeah, so it's
that's
like
that's delicious.
You too. Mm-hmm. And I remember
maybe a little butterscotch too.
Is it Aaron? I think Aaron was the first.
You're one. Aaron.
I'm Aaron, but A-A-A-R-R-A-N.
Oh,
I remember they an Amarone cask, I believe, and I remember it being really. It's a drier wine. Am I right?
Mm.
Right. And you get that.
Yeah, the finish. Yeah.
How long does it stay in the Amarone cask?
Well, that's a good question.
A year?
I think
six
it was
months?
About a year. Or... I think it was about a year, but I actually don't know that off the top of my head for this one.
So it goes from SGR cask to this?
No, it went from ex-bourbon. Oh, so okay. Ex-bourbon is our other true love of a cask at Ning Nian. It might actually be my favorite cask if I had to pick only one, which I would
never
obviously
tell. Can we ask where you get your cask from?
That was my next question. So go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So our bourbon cask come from a Kentucky bourbon barrel who are a broker, obviously, in Kentucky.
Oh, okay.
We get a lot. Within that, we get a number of sources, but a lot of them are Brown-Forman sourced. But yeah, the bourbon casks, I don't know, they let the spirit shine through, and I think the spirit is what I really love. That's the bit that I'm totally passionate about in the whole whiskey making thing. You know, a cask finish is awesome, but I think the tunes that you can play in the actual distillery are so cool and underexplored. And I think the bourbon cask let that shine through the most of all cask types. And most of our cask finishes, with the exception of the stout cask finish that we tried as the second whiskey, most of our cask finishes will have come from bourbon because it's a nice kind of base chilled out cask type on which you can build a cask finish on top.
Like chocolate, citrus, there's a little bit of, I don't know, Christmassy things going on in here. It's really good. Mm-hmm. I like it. And that dryness, and I love the finish on it. Oh, the finish is great. So is this available in the States?
It is only available in the States.
Yeah, this is
nearly
exclusive. Yeah. It is exclusive for the States, which is why I don't have it. Exactly. It is only
it's so exclusive.
You didn't get to keep any?
You don't get
much, actually. We did keep some, but it's gone. So, yeah.
It is a business. It is whiskey business. So you
gotta sell.
You got to sell.
Get it out the door.
Exactly.
I was watching one of your promotional videos, and you have a, I don't want to say gin because I don't think you guys use the word gin, but a gin, is it, do you call it gin? It's a gin-like product.
Great question. Have... yes and no. we do have a gin, but it's not a gin.
Is this the spirit?
Yeah, that
and
one.
And it's not available in the US, so...
Right.
Yeah, so we call it a botanical spirit. It is not available in the US, so don't get too excited. It's actually the first ever product we released. And the reason it is not a gin is because it starts as our unaged whiskey, so it starts as new make. Ooh. And we then layer on top botanicals and distill it like a gin. But with a gin, you would normally start with vodka, redistill it with botanicals, and thus you have a gin. Whereas we start with our unaged whiskey, new make, and redistill it. And that's why we can't call it a gin, because actually the regs, at least in the UK and Europe, I haven't actually checked the US regs, but at least in the UK and Europe, they require gin to start basically as vodka, 96% ethyl alcohol with no underlying agricultural taste. Whereas we, the botanical spirit we say is like whiskey and gin had a baby, you get that lovely malty flavor from the new make, but you also get all the botanicals. And the botanicals are some of the classic gin botanicals, juniper and coriander. But they also, we also have this crazy herb or plant called bog myrtle, which grows in vast quantities around the distillery. It's a little bush. And it's really kind of grassy, citrusy. And we use an enormous amount of that as well as seven other botanicals to make it. So, yeah, it's we say it drinks like a gin, but legally we can't call it a gin.
Hmm. Wow. So I was going to ask you if you sold the new make, and I guess you do in a way.
Well, in a way.
Actually, yeah, this is the bottle for it.
It's very pretty. I'm looking at it right now.
The bottle's very cool.
So say we knew somebody. Could we get them to send us a bottle?
I mean, I think say we knew somebody.
It's the great state of New Jersey, and anything comes to my door.
Mail anything. I'm thinking like Dawn Davies.
Right to the door. Right to the door.
But I think you can actually order it from the Whiskey Exchange as well for US shipping. So, but it was actually, I mean, you ask about the new make, and that's actually where it came from. In our, in 2017, when we started distilling, anyone who visited us, which I'll be honest, was not many people in those days because we're right at the end of a long road and we're a new distillery. But obviously, anyone who did visit us only got the new make to try. That was all we had. And so that's what they got. And people kept saying what amazing new make they thought it was. And I think a lot of our philosophy is focused on the spirit and making the new make as delicious as possible before it even hits a cask. And people kept saying, oh, it's so delicious, why don't you bottle it? And I thought, there's not really much scale in that. And then separately, I went out with a forager locally who kind of opened my eyes to the amazing flavor and plants around the distillery. And I kind of put those two things together. And I didn't expect it initially to get so close to a gin, but interestingly, we couldn't make it taste nice just with local plants. So we ended up adding in juniper and coriander, and that's where we ended up. So
that's a great idea.
Hyper-localness
of it.
I'm looking at your UK shop, and it says that if you return the bottle, that could be refilled. Mm-hmm. Do a lot of people do that? Did they have to return the canister as well or just the bottle?
No, just the bottle. I mean, if you did return the canister, we'd absolutely reuse it, actually. We should probably add that. Great idea. Yes, a lot of people do it, but a small percentage of our sales are through our web shop.
Okay.
So six of one, half a dozen of the other. But you know what even more people do? If you come to the distillery, you can physically bring your bottle and refill it there out of
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
And you get a big discount. And you know, when we were first thinking about this, I was talking to Amy, who was our head of sustainability at the time, and I was like, I think it's a nice idea, but I think it's not going to be that big a deal. And but one of the KPIs that we track is percentage of Nicknean Organic, which is our flagship whiskey, sold in the distillery in new bottles versus refill bottles. And every year it goes up.
Wow. Oh, that's great.
But I guess it's difficult for the special editions, right? Because
right.
The labeling
so you
is
can't, all that. Exactly. But if you, so the only thing that we offer, the only liquid you can put into a bottle is Nicknean Organic. Because normally we've bottled all, if it's a limited edition,
everything else is gone.
But if you were to bring us a Quiet Rebel Simon bottle, we'd of course put Nicknean Organic in it.
Okay, that's fair.
It used to drive me crazy when you'd go into a coffee place with your own mug and they wouldn't let you put tea or whatever, right? You have to get their paper cup. Years ago, I think it's at Starbucks, I think will let you use a mug, I think. They don't want to touch anything.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And I assume they did this in the UK as well, but growing up, we had returnable bottles. Like if you bought beer, it was the hard cardboard case and the 24 bottles. You bring it back to the, we have beer distributors in Pennsylvania. You bring it back to the beer distributor. They give you a credit. You buy another case. There was a
soda. Well, now we have. They took the buck off the case, whatever, and you're in.
Yeah. And now we pay a recycling, in essence, a recycling fee, whatever it is. And because people won't actually physically take them to a recycling center, you're paying that fee getting money back. Now you just pay it at the grocery store with every bottle, a nickel or whatever it is. And then you're kind of expected to, everyone, hopefully, will put it in the recycling bin and it does get recycled, which is a whole complicated story. I know you guys had some crazy, I love the word that you guys use, you call a scheme, and that's like a legal term, right? And I remember Jess from Singlecast Nation was talking about this a number of years ago when this crazy scheme came out about recycling. And it went completely south. It was like this crazy idea from the government, and then it didn't work, right?
I
saw you in an article talk about this, and it was you were just dying about it.
So it's called the deposit return scheme, and it's exactly what you've just been talking about, which is you buy a bottle of whiskey or buy a bottle of anything, and you pay an extra 50p on the bottle, and then you take it back to a recycling point and you get 50p back.
Right.
And you probably shouldn't even ask me about this because we might be here for another hour, but so in theory, this should be great, right? Because not enough bottles get recycled. And in particular, this was aimed at plastic. I mean, actually a lot of glass gets recycled, and there was a lot of debate about whether glass should go into it, and really sensible people said it shouldn't because most glass gets recycled anyway, so what's the big deal? But this was the Scottish government trying to do it on its own without the English and the Welsh government at that point. There is now a UK-wide scheme that is going to be implemented, I think, next year. But the Scots wanted to do it early, and part of this was driven by the fact that the Scottish Nationalist Party were in coalition with the Greens, who were driving it hard. The execution of it was like Jeremy Clarkson style bad.
Season 7.
They made 144 pounds at the end of the year.
No, they didn't. They ended up losing the taxpayer multiple millions, like I think 20 to 30 million. It's actually really, that end of it is actually it's really bad. But you know, And the thing, the really annoying thing, these schemes exist in Europe. And actually, you say this stuff used to exist in the US. It used to exist in the UK. In Europe, it still exists. This stuff still goes on. There are functioning schemes. A sensible person could have looked at them, replicated them. But no, they decided to do it their own way.
They invent the wheel.
And basically, if like us, you were selling your bottles of whiskey at the end of a remote peninsula, you had to act as a return point for everybody else.
Oh,
so everybody could have driven with their plastic water bottles down the end of the road to Nickmean and deposited them. And right. Then we needed some way of getting them. Honestly, it was farcically bad. And they had gone all the way. They'd appointed like people to build recycling locations in big supermarket car parks. And then the hammer blow was a legal intervention that said basically you couldn't make trade within the UK. You can put up barriers to trade within the UK, and clearly there's a barrier to trade because the rules were different to Scotland to England. So the whole thing got kiboshed in this like legal technicality. And now there's all these old like deposit return points in supermarket car parks, many of which have been turned into very creative things. And at some point they will become deposit return points again, but hopefully in due time with like proper consultation, basically, which it didn't happen in the first place. All very silly.
The government, what a great idea.
Yes, you put them in charge of more expensiveness. It's what you get. Oh my god, that's crazy. Well, this has been a wonderfully fun.
Hey, Aaron, your audio is getting a little wacky.
Oh, I'm sorry. This has been a really wonderful visit.
Still fuzzy.
Can't hear a word you're saying.
Still fuzzy.
You guys know how to talk. You talk.
Talk amongst yourselves.
Go ahead, Mike. Finish us off. Finish
well,
it off.
Thanks. This was really great. It was a great show you recommended we watch, and you sent us three fantastic whiskeys. Breakfast, dinner, and dinner. Maybe just all dinner. I don't really know. I've had a lot to drink.
Would you have any of these with a cigar, Mike?
I would have all of these with a cigar.
There you go.
I really enjoy dipping. It's, again, if you're going down, go down in a big way. So I got a lot of vices working my way. And I find that scotch in particular is a delicious companion for a good cigar. You dip the ends, smoke the cigar, have a little whiskey while you're out there. It's nice. But the Huntress, really, again, the way you spoke about it in terms of, you know, playing with the yeasts and trying to come up with different flavors and doing different things, it certainly came across as something totally different from what we would typically see. And that was just delicious. The Quiet Rebels, again, something different, using different kind of casks, the use of a stout cask an STR cask that was stouted, and then you put something in it afterwards. And Innocent Gun, if you're going to use stout people, you know, use good people making good beer. That was just, again, another great, great whiskey. Really, really, cool. Two really good ones.
And well, there was one thing. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mike. Finish that.
No, you can jump in.
Okay. One quick question. And it's, you know, you can't ignore it. The packaging. Is it all designed in-house? Do you work with the design firm? Do you have a designer on site?
Great questions.
And now the main reason, the big reason I ask is because my son, who's going off to start his first year in college, his major is going to be, I think it's packaging design and systems.
So, fascinating.
So he's now kind of, you know, he's looking at it, oh, I could design that. I could design this. I could design that. So anyway, go ahead.
A mixture is the answer. So we worked with an agency early on. So this is the point where it's literally just me and the company. And I think I can do the, like, I know where I want to get to, but I'm not an artistic person and I couldn't visualize the aesthetics of what I wanted. So an agency helped us with the broad kind of, what does the brand look like? So, you know, fonts, color palette, that sort of thing. And they also worked with an artist called Charlotte, who physically painted in, you know, on paper, lots of the plants that grew around the distillery. So that all happened back in 2016. And then when it came to the actual packaging, that same agency helped us design the bottle. But since then, it's all been done in-house. So it's a mixture. So for example, the tubes, Quiet Rebel tubes that look like this pattern had been created by the agency, but we in-house put it all together to make it an actual tube. Okay. And so, yeah, now we do it all in-house. I mean, you know, if we need something totally, and we've actually started doing some artist bottlings where we'll feature artists on the label. Obviously, that's a collaboration externally, but now it's mostly done in-house.
I mean, it's very striking. I mean, it obviously, you know, it gets your attention. You know, it's not, it also helps that the stuff inside the bottles, you know, equally as beautiful. So that helps.
Most importantly.
Yes. You know, although, you know, the bottle itself, hell of a decoration. Like, you know, make it a really nice lamp.
And sadly, I've bought my fair share of bottles that were very pretty, but did not taste very good. Yeah.
Exactly. Wow. But then you never get a second sale. So that's kind of pointless. But yeah, my house is littered with olive oil pourers, lamps, candlesticks made out of Nick Meehan bottles. But that's okay with me, because then it stays around in people's houses. That's a good thing.
My my barber takes the bottles and puts a spray bottle top on it. And they use the bottles just spray in water so to wet your hair down. So you go by and you're just like, are those are whiskey bottles, aren't they? Yes, they are. We've repurposed them.
I may have to switch barbershops. Although I have nothing to spray, so so it doesn't really matter.
I'm really not keeping anything down. I see other people with the bottles. I don't really get them. And lastly, I wanted the XM or any cast. Again, it's three whiskeys. The difference isn't just the ABV. The difference is all the technology that went and the thought that went behind it. And you created three singular expressions that are just really, they're really good. I mean, they're just so good.
They're fun. We always look forward to a nickname. It's always a good time.
Thanks, guys. It's been such a pleasure to chat. And I think, I mean, it's just genius. TV and whiskey. What's not to love?
Sure. So anyway, well, thank you, Annabelle, for coming on. Thank you for, you know, coordinating the whiskey deliveries to us. You know, you got a great team working in the States for you.
Anytime.
And maybe if we find ourselves headed towards nowhere, we'll drive 11 miles and then make a turn and drive a mile and a half more and... then we'll be there.
Exactly. Scotland's on my list. I got to get there.
Perhaps more practically, if you're in London, look me up, because I'm occasionally hanging out there too.
All right, that'll work too. So stick around for a few minutes. You know, we'll do the closing video and all that stuff. The podcast will be out in about a week. So once I get it downloaded and, you know, Aaron writes his little intro, we'll get this out there and we'll, you know, obviously tag all of you lovely people and let you know it's out there. So thank you again. And we're going to sign off. Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers.
If you enjoy this show, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, Audible, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. You can also find us on boozedancing.com. And if you have any questions, comments, show, or drink suggestions, email us at boozedancing@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.